Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Oh, wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
Shorts!
From
WNYC.
See?
Yes.
And NPR.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
The podcast.
Yes.
Thank you.
See, we're a little off our game right now because we are not in our normal studio. We're actually in Detroit right now. We're on tour. We're in the first leg of our tour. It's super fun, going well. But we do have an interesting podcast for you.
We do indeed. But it might be more efficient if we go back to New York where Soren Wheeler is standing by, because he and I had a conversation with someone. We can just...
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to carry it, Soren?
Sure.
Do it.
So today... we have a story of an obsession that swallowed reporter Dan Engberg pretty much whole.
Yeah.
Of all the things to catch your attention, how did this happen to pop into your head?
It happened to pop into my head because I was talking to a friend of mine who's an elementary school teacher, and we were discussing quicksand, as one does.
Oh, of course.
This elementary school teacher and I. And she just said, you know, the kids in my class just don't even, they've never heard of quicksand.
Like second graders, third grade, like what?
Nine-year-olds.
Well, that's like fourth graders.
That's prime time for quicksand.
Right. When I was nine, quicksand was a major part of my life.
Yeah.
We would, you know, pour water in the corner of the sandbox and say, oh, it's quicksand.
But your teacher friend's students didn't.
Right. But so I went to her, I visited her class, and I discovered that she was wrong. Almost all of them had heard of quicksand. But she was right insofar as quicksand was not important to them. In fact, they thought it wasn't scary at all. And I was like, well, what are you afraid of? And they said, you know...
zombies, the alien in Pacific Rim.
Ghosts.
When I was actually lost in writing.
Being attacked by a dinosaur.
That would be totally more scary.
So we actually went and talked to some third graders. And while some of them said...
well, I guess it's sort of scary, but...
most of them weren't scared of it at all.
I don't think so.
I usually don't think about it.
They thought it was something that maybe their parents had been afraid of.
My dad told me that when he was little, his friends always said, like, look out, that could be quicksand.
Your friends ever say that to you?
No.
They would say people used to be scared of that, but it's not scary anymore. So that got me to thinking, what happened? Why is quicksand not scary the way it used to be?
And with that simple question, Dan got sucked into a world he never even knew existed.
So the next step was going to the internet, and within a minute, I discovered the quicksand fetish community.
The quicksand fetish.
Yeah.
Like fetish? Like sex fetish?
Yes.
Oh.
So among the quicksand fetishists, there are so-called sinkers. These are people who seek out quicksand in nature and want to jump in.
With another person and kiss or by themselves with no clothes on? Or where's the sex part?
Some of them by themselves with no clothes on. Some smaller group with another person. That's if they can convince their partner to come with them. But
they always have a rope with them, I hope.
Oh, yeah. Oh, if you go onto the sinkers message boards, there's a Google map which has sinking spots all over the world, and each one is rated for, you know, thickness, depth, privacy, available parking nearby. I mean, it's like a very thought through and wonderfully collaborative community.
Oh, wow.
So there's sinkers on one hand, and then there are the watchers. They just want to see people or animals sinking into quicksand. So they'll watch movies and just find the quicksand sequence in the movie.
And here's where Dan sunk even deeper. Because he discovered that one of these watchers,
this guy Crypto,
had, in the course of his fetishistic quicksand watching,
collated this, you know, this list of well over 1,000 quicksand scenes.
It's quicksand!
In film and television.
Quicksand. Quicksand. This part of the country?
No way.
That's nice.
There were scenes going all the way back to the birth of filmmaking.
I mean, this is the greatest impetus for scientific research.
I ought to take off your shoe and paddle you.
If you have like a fetishistic interest in the data.
And Dan thought, maybe this data can give us a clue about how the way we think about quicksand has changed.
So I went through and I pulled out every feature film from the list. And then with information from the MPAA, I figured out how many movies were being released every decade. And then I sort of computed what percent of movies had quicksand in every decade. Going back to the first quicksand movie they have is from 1909. It's a silent film where a woman gets rescued from quicksand by some hooded monks. I'm unable to find this movie, but I'd love to see it. I don't know what it's about. But anyways, I started looking at the number of movies by decade, and the beginning of the century, it's like 1 in 1,000 movies. By the 30s, it's up to 1 in 500. And then in the 40s, 1 in 200. And then in the 1960s, all of a sudden, it just shoots up. Like 1 in 35, like almost 3% of Hollywood movies have quicksand. The 1960s are just clearly a moment for quicksand.
And Dan says, it wasn't just the number of films. The quicksand scenes that showed up in the 60s were serious, dramatic scenes. For example,
Lawrence of Arabia, where Peter O'Toole is, you know, pushing through the dust storm to try to save his companion who's being sucked under. That movie won 7 Oscars. And then Woman in the Dunes came out. This, like, artsy Japanese existentialist meditation.
And for about the next 10 years, Dan says, you had all these serious films that featured quicksand.
And then
it fell off dramatically.
In the 1970s, it's already fallen to something like 1 out of 75. And then by the 1980s, it's like 1 out of 130. And then in the 90s, quicksand is mostly gone.
Huh.
And I think also in the 80s, it had migrated into
television. I'm stuck in quicksand.
Boy, are you having one bad day.
Larry and Balky in Perfect Strangers are falling into quicksand. There's quicksand in My Little Pony. There's quicksand in Rainbow Pride. I mean, it's zany quicksand.
Basically, Dan says, quicksand had become a joke.
And so, and that's the end, I think, when quicksand's in, you know, Saturday cartoons.
I do think that adventure gags probably have a lifespan. And
so just for a gut check, Dan and I decided maybe we should run this past somebody who knows the business.
I'm Carlton Cues, and I'm a television writer and producer.
And Carlton was actually the showrunner for the TV show Lost.
And that's a show that by rights should have tons of quicksand. I mean,
absolutely.
They should be in quicksand all the time. They're stranded on a tropical island. It's an adventure show.
But according to Carlton, whenever one of the writers would say, you know,
okay, so Kate goes running down a path and then all of a sudden she falls into a pit of quicksand,
the rest of them would be like
I don't know if we can really pull that off. So
what is that bag? Like, what is it that would make that not, I don't know.
You know, I just think a lot of people would sort of be rolling their eyes and not buying it. I know it sounds kind of crazy because, you know, here you are making sort of a crazy show with smoke monsters and polar bears and time travel. And for someone to say, no, but we don't believe quicksand. I know it's, but ultimately you just sort of trust your gut. And just right now where quicksand is just not sort of, I think, the right metaphor for how we're all feeling.
But in the 60s, it was.
Has someone speculated as to the reason why the 60s?
Oh, I've speculated at great length. I mean, it's a fascinating moment because it's not just in movies.
I believe that this nation should commit itself.
So, we're planning the moon mission in the early 60s.
Landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
And this Cornell astronomer named Thomas Gold says, what if when the Apollo lander descends to the surface of the moon, it just sinks into a lunar quicksand?
I remember this.
And
I remember Tom Gold saying that, too.
Yeah, so right at this golden moment of quicksand, people are discussing real-life quicksand on the frontier of that era.
Now is the time.
And then 1963, Martin Luther King
now is the time.
Makes his I Have a Dream speech.
To lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice.
And he says, now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice.
This evening,
and then
I came here to speak to you about Vietnam.
There was Vietnam.
I do not have to tell you that our people are profoundly concerned about that struggle.
You know, we now think of Vietnam as having been a quagmire. That's the rhetoric that's used now. But the debate in the 60s between Daniel Ellsberg and Arthur Schlesinger, they use quicksand and quagmire interchangeably. Ellsberg will switch off in one essay. He'll call it a quicksand and then a quagmire. But the first use of that idea was to describe it as a quicksand, and then it kind of migrates from being a quicksand to a quagmire over the course of the late 60s and early 70s. And now, I mean, more evidence. Now we call it a quagmire. We forgot that Vietnam was a quicksand before it was a quagmire. So on all of these levels, quicksand is just, you know, is part of these key moments of this 1960s.
Wow.
So the question that, you know, that was just, I was obsessed with for a long time was, why did America fall into quicksand in the 1960s? I mean, did it come out of the movies and suddenly everyone's talking about it? Or was everyone talking about it?
And so maybe everybody saw Lawrence of Arabia and they all went back to their jobs.
Right.
Some were on rocket ship jobs and some were on warrior jobs. And they all just carried Peter O'Toole in their heads. It's possible, I suppose.
That's possible. Who knows? My sense is that it's had to do with just sort of a generalized anxiety about going someplace radically new. Anxiety about, you know, the hubris of traveling to the moon. Anxiety about social upheaval. Anxiety about the foreign entanglement of Vietnam and the state of geopolitics.
But why would those anxieties manifest themselves in terms of, like, quicksand? Why?
Well, I think it's this idea that you're going to get sucked in. You're going to go too far. You're going to get stuck in whatever new world you've ventured into. And right now, there isn't that anxiety of exploration anymore. I mean, quicksand in Shakespeare's time was always off the coasts of new continents. It had to do with the age of exploration. And then it became, you know, desert quicksand and jungle quicksand during colonial era. And I just think the world is...
And then it became the moon.
Yeah, and then it became the moon. And
well, look at all the real estate that's beyond the moon. Come on. I mean, you got, like, our solar system. You could have the quicksand of Jupiter.
Yes, absolutely. I think if we're going to land humans on some...
Or black holes. Aren't black holes a kind of quicksand?
Yeah, this is my guarantee. If we're about to land humans on some planet, you know, beyond the moon, these thoughts of quicksand would reemerge.
Oh, yeah.
This is Carlton Cuse again.
And now we're going to see this whole new chapter of Star Wars, and clearly...
It just so happens that the director, J.J. Abrams, is working on a whole new Star Wars movie.
Yes. And I think in the context of some strange new world, I think the audience would totally buy quicksand there.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah. So I'll shoot J.J. an email and just say... quicksand, and just leave it at that. See what happens.
I have another leading indicator of quicksand interest for you.
I have no idea what you're about to say. None.
So, when I was a kid, I played quicksand in the sandbox But sandboxes disappeared in the 1990s, in New York City at least. I don't know what the story was in the rest of the country, but this paper came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it warned that there might be some asbestos derivative in sandbox sand. And the number of sandboxes in New York City went from something like 900 to 30 or 40 by the mid-90s.
And those kids that you talked to in that class, they had not likely mm-hmm. sat in a sandbox pouring water in the right. corner and worrying about
it. But sandboxes are back. The new imaginative play movement and playground redesign. So it's just we're going to have lots of sand and lots of water, and we want the kids mixing the water in the sand. So who knows? Maybe this is the front edge of quicksand coming back because kids are playing with water and sand in sandboxes in New York City.
Wow, that's. By the way, on a more serious note, I have actually one more leading indicator of the return of quicksand. I just saw it in the New York Times, actually, on the front page.
Really? In what connection?
Involving Syria.
Syria? They were referring to Syria as a quicksand.
Yeah, and I think they've actually, it's come up a little bit in terms of Afghanistan, too. But
wow.
It kind of seems to be back
it's
in,
back.
In that, in the political wow. scene, too.
Thank you, Søren.
Thanks, Søren, yeah.
No problem. And I should say thanks to Dan Nengber. He's a writer and a columnist at Slate Magazine, where you can find his article about quicksand. And if you want to check out where the Radiolab live show is and when it is and how you can get there and how you can get tickets, you can do all of that at radiolab.org/live. Thanks for listening.
Hello, this is Estefania Elorriaga, originally from Caracas, Venezuela, and currently living in Corvallis, Oregon. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.